Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. So in this fourth of the series of talk for the Rains Retreat 2007, I'll be continuing just on the process of meditation. Rather than giving theoretical talks at this stage of the retreat, I really want to emphasize that what one does in one's heart to try and smooth the way for peaceful mind states, for the happiness, to get that mindfulness strong and penetrating so that one can see problems, even actually see some of the Dhamma and fix up the difficulties of one's life. And today's talk will be dealing with some of the obstacles in which we find in meditation and what those obstacles are and just skillful means of overcoming them. I know that yesterday and today Ajahn Bhumali took one of the pumps into the shop to get fixed. It would be very wonderful if you could just take your brain into some sort of shop and get fixed up so it works properly again. Unfortunately, the mind is not that easy to deal with, which is why we do have these amazing practices. And one always should remember that this practice of meditation has been going for such a long time. There is not any problem which you have which other monks haven't faced in the past and which they haven't overcome in the past. This is a well-worn path of calming the mind and bringing it to a state of peace, power, and happiness. So that well-worn path has faced many of those obstacles that you face. It's just that how we remember those strategies to overcome those obstacles and our motivation and diligence in putting those strategies into place, to employing so the medicines which fix up the diseases of the mind. And usually when it comes to the third or fourth week of a retreat, one of the big problems is boredom, especially in a monastery like this, which hasn't got that much going on for most of you. And I know that being a young monk in Thailand, very often we complain there was too many things going on and there was too much work, there were too many people, there were too many ceremonies, there's too much morning chanting, too much evening chanting. And we just would just fantasize. I would sometimes fantasize of being in a monastery where there was no morning meetings or evening meetings, where you had hardly any work at all, where you could just sit and walk all day. You fantasize about monasteries such as that. And of course, once you found a monastery like that, you get very bored, restless, and suffer a lot, and fantasize about, oh, if I could only find a monastery where there was work, there was something to do. Maybe you could talk to people and have at least something to do in the evening, like some chanting, or maybe group meditation. And this was just missing the whole point of what was happening. Because it's important, the standard in the suttas, the standard of the forest tradition, is to have lots of time in solitude, to have little work and little contact with each other. And it's certainly that those of you who have investigated the original or earliest teachings of the Buddha in the suttas and the Vinaya know that seclusion is important. Solitude is praised by the Buddha, which is why that I try my hardest to try and arrange this monastery to give the maximum possible seclusion, to have the least meetings rather than the most. Even though that gives the opportunity for things like boredom and even restlessness and fantasies and getting really fed up with one's own company, nevertheless, it's worth facing that and finding the strategies to overcome it. So one should investigate boredom sometimes. Where is that boredom coming from? A lot of times that boredom is coming from just coming the transition from a more busy lifestyle to a more settled lifestyle. Even like some young people who come to a monastery such as this just think it's boring because there's no TVs, that there's iPods, there was no, at least not with music on anyway. There's nothing much to entertain you. And when you look at boredom, that boredom is always like a relative reaction to where one came from and what one is facing now. You know, for what you would think is like excitement in this monastery, maybe like toast in the morning, that for all the people in the world would think, you know, so what, big deal, that's boring, can't we have something a bit more exciting than toast? Is that all you guys, you know, ever fantasize about? But when you actually look at what I'm talking about here, that when one moves from an active lifestyle to a less active lifestyle, the mind is not used to dealing with such subtle and peaceful states. It just hasn't accustomed itself to the lack of stimulation. And all it needs is like a while to settle down. Eventually, in what at first, when you come from activity into less activity, appears boring, after a while, staying in that less activity state, you find that you do start to wake up to the interesting parts of that lifestyle, to the enjoyable and delightful parts of just being alone and having nothing much to do. The simile of going from a lit room into a dark room, like this evening, if you go out from this hall and just go out without your flashlight, you can't see at first. It takes a while for the eyes to accustom itself to the darkness. And then after a while you can see little shapes. I know this monastery so well that sometimes, some evenings, if I forget my flashlight, or if I come back from Nolamara on a Sunday and I haven't got the flashlight because I've been away all weekend, very often you don't need a flashlight to walk from the dining area back up to my hut. I know the path so well, and there's enough light from the stars to know which way I should go. But I have to wait for a while for my eyes to accustom to the lesser light, and then I can see things. In the same way, when one goes from activity to less activity, it takes a while for the mind to accommodate to the lessening of sensory stimulation. After a while, it does accommodate. In what was once boring, uninteresting, nothing much to grab the mind, you start to see in that same space some beautiful and interesting and delightful aspects. So the first strategy when one is bored is to be patient with that boredom. Leave it alone. Don't try and fill up that boring hole with some activity. If you're doing that, you're just stimulating the mind again. It's like you're going outside, but you start to look for a light to turn on, and you miss the experience of the more subtle shapes in darkness. Even as you know, a couple of weeks ago that I went out for that evening with Sir Roger Penrose, and part of what we did was, you know, because he was a famous scientist, it was in this gravity center, they had the telescopes out, and it happened to be a clear night, so you could actually see things like Jupiter and its moons. But when we first went into the observatory, we had to wait for a few moments because they had to turn all the lights off so that we could accustom our eyes just to the starlight, so we could move around through the telescopes. And of course, it was a case of just waiting a while. And because the lights were dimmed, you can see these amazing, beautiful stars in the sky. In the same way that you need to dim the sensory activity to see the beautiful, if you like, stars in the mind. Of course, we're talking about nimittas here, but also talking about the subtle, peaceful, beautiful happinesses which occur when the five senses are subdued. So by calming those five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching down, it's quite common to go through that stage of boredom. You know, when the lights are turned off and one can't see yet and there's nothing to grab the attention. What is important is one is patient and has faith that if one just stays in that boredom, soon the mind will begin to see things which are very interesting, which you couldn't see there at first. In the same way that many people are just coming to Buddhism or going to sort of an art gallery or listening to fine music. You get so bored stiff with fine music. I want Jimi Hendrix techno or something which is more exciting. But after a while, when you calm down that excitement of the senses, you can savour some things which are far more delightful. And so the calming down goes through boredom. And if one stays in that boring state and one doesn't interrupt this whole process, after a while the boredom turns into something beautiful when the mind opens up to that more subtle landscape of the mind and one starts to really appreciate what's happening there in solitude. Patience is an important strategy to develop for a monk. Sometimes it does take a long time. Even for myself, that sometimes when you're meditating, it takes a while for the mind to really settle down and get into the meditation process. And sometimes it's not just boredom, but sometimes it's restlessness which comes up into the mind. One doesn't want to sit still. The body is uncomfortable. The mind just will not sort of get into the breath or whatever other meditation object you're trying to focus on. And of course it's because we're forcing it too much. Sometimes the best thing to do is just to be patient and wait. Allow the restlessness to be, rather than trying to control it. One of the great strategies which I often talk about and mentioned in the book of Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond was the strategy of the water buffalo mind. And that story in outside Wat Nanachat, when Ajahn Jacquo was the abbot there and I was his second monk, and he came here and I followed him as second monk again. It was my karma to stay with that monk for so many years. But it happened one morning, early one morning, just while I'd already gone on alms round, and Ajahn Jacquo, being the abbot, went on the later alms round to Bung Wai village. Before he actually got to the alms round, a man came running in to the monastery with half his finger missing because he'd been taking his water buffalo out to graze. The water buffalo had got scared, tried to run away. The string wound around this guy's finger. He tried to hold the water buffalo back, and all that happened was the water buffalo took half his finger off. And of course, it was a very, very bloodied finger. I didn't see the wound myself because immediately Ajahn Jacquo got a car and took him to hospital. But I saw him the next couple of days with a bandaged finger, and obviously later on with like half a finger. That was actually poor Am's son, if anyone knows that man. He's probably quite old now, retired, but if he's still alive, you'll notice he has one finger shorter than all the rest. And the reason was he did not know how to deal with the restless water buffalo. And the same strategy which you should use when your mind is restless should be just to let it go, not to try and hold it back. Because sometimes that when restlessness is like that and you try and stop it and control it, and you'll experience this, it just gets worse. It gets more wanton, more difficult. Really, all you need to do is just, okay, mind, if that's what you want to do, off you go. And your job is just to be mindfully at peace and just seeing where this silly old mind wants to go and explore. Your job is not to stop the mind, but to understand it, to watch it, to be kind to it, to be gentle to it. It's as if you're dealing with a little child, and the child wants to run this way and that way. All those children, the 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds who come to our monastery, they make such a loud noise, and they're screaming. And sometimes we had a nice meditation that really pierces your mind, at least it does mine. And it's quite unpleasant to hear those children scream like that, at least for me. But nevertheless, that's their nature to do things like that. I can't expect those kids to do anything different. In the same way that it's the nature of your mind, because of causes and conditions outside yourself, it's nothing to do with you. Please don't get into guilt trips with your restless mind. It's not yours. It's not me. It's not a problem. It's just nature of things. It's arising according to karmic causes from the past. And you can't go in the past and stop those causes. You're stuck with the result right now. The mind wants to run off. And of course, the only thing to do, as I've been stressing, remember the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, just let go, be kind, be gentle. Beautiful teachings, straight to the point, shows you your attitude to what's happening is the most important part of meditation. Let go. In other words, let that water buffalo of a mind run off. Be kind and be gentle. And if you do things like that, just as we all know if we've lived in Thailand or even Sri Lanka, that water buffalo runs off but not that far. Usually half a kilometer at most. And then it sort of settles down. And it waits for its owner because it's part of the family. It likes staying with its owner. So the man just needs to slowly walk after the water buffalo. Okay, it's a bit of an extra exercise, but that's much better than having your finger torn off. And then you can go and grab the rope again and gently lead the water buffalo where you wanted to take it anyway. And you just wasted a little bit of time, that's all, but at least you don't have to go to hospital. In the same way, when your mind gets restless, when it gets crazy, wants to think of all sorts of things, your job is to let it go with kindness and gentleness, not with indulgence or force, because if you give it force and indulgence, you actually feed that water buffalo mind. By indulgence, it means you really push it along. Come on, think a bit more about sex or about the future or about movies or about music or whatever else you think about when you're restless. But if you keep on pushing it that way, of course, it will keep on going. But if you just stand back and be equanimous, be let go, be kind, be gentle, you'll find that water buffalo mind will soon stop. It won't go that far. So restlessness doesn't need to be a battle. If restlessness is a battle, you know that the reason why the restlessness gets stronger is because you feed it with negativity or with guilt or just basic indulgence. You're not really facing it in a proper way. You're making more bad karma, unwholesome karma, with what you're facing. So when you are restless, just be at peace with it. Sometimes you just sit with it. Okay, mind, you want to go. And you don't be the driver, but you be the passenger. By being a driver, you know what I mean when you're driving the restless mind. Being a passenger means just sitting in the back and just seeing where all this ends up, but with complete non-involvement. The idea of non-involvement or disengaging is one of the wonderful attitudes which I use for my meditation. I disengage from things. So you're watching this mind and it does this or it thinks that, and it's like you're standing back and just watching it from a distance without getting involved. The best metaphor for that, which gives the idea of disengagement very clearly, is the sitting in a movie theater, in a cinema. If you're sitting in a cinema just watching the movie, sometimes you get involved with the movie. People start to cry or get excited or get scared. And when you think about that, why do people do that? Now, everybody knows it's just a movie. It's just actors. As when I was told as a kid by my father, it's not blood, it's only tomato sauce. They probably use something different than tomato sauce these days, but that's what my father said they used to do in the old days. I thought, what a waste of tomato sauce. It would be better on fish and chips, but that was another thing altogether. The point was that it wasn't real. It was just a movie. And as long as you can stand back and remember that, it's just causes and conditionings just rolling on. Not me, not mine, not a self. Nothing to do with me. If you can only remember that, then you can watch restlessness or boredom or whatever with this sense of disinterest or disengagement. This is a knower and just knowing something. So you imagine yourself when you're meditating, sitting inside. Okay, this is dangerous in the sense that sometimes it can get into a sense of a self, an essential me or a mind or a knower or the one who knows, watching all of this, but it's helpful at times just to use that as a stepping stone to peace, to see this thing which I call the know is just a process, not a self, not an entity, but for the time being, make use of the idea of a knower. And if you make the idea of a knower like the person, the patron sitting in the seat in the movie theater, and you're just watching all this thing play on the screen, but you always remember this, the one who's knowing is not involved in all of this. What happens is you do get a sense of detachment from what's happening. And from that sense of detachment, there can be that sort of letting go, that gentleness and that kindness. Whenever there's an involvement there, whenever it's your meditation, I'm getting bad and I'm fed up with this, whenever there's that me in there, it's like you're watching a movie and you get sort of excited by it or got disappointed by it, or you cry or you get afraid because of the movie. I was just reminded by one of the monks the other day about that story of the movie theatre in Jamaica, the drive-in movie theatre which had a screen made of concrete, a foot thick, only because... This is a drive-in movie theatre, only because all the patrons of that town in Jamaica, they loved cowboys and Indians, westerns, because they loved gunfights, and whenever there was a gunfight on the screen, they would get out their guns and join in. You can imagine that. It even gives me a smile now to think of all these guys in their cars, probably convertibles or something, or sitting on the ground, and whenever there was a gunfight on the movie theatre, they'd go and shoot this person or that person. Would have been good fun, except for the owner of the movie theatre, who went through so many cloth screens, decided the only way he could keep his business going was to erect a concrete screen, which is why they had the concrete screen movie theatre. And you can see what the reason I bring this up is: people get involved, and they want to shoot the sheriff, or they want to shoot, you know, the cowboy or the Indian or whoever else it is on the screen. You can see how you want to shoot the restless mind, or you want to sort of destroy the boredom, or you want to sort of get involved in this. And that's how we get attached and involved and create more problems for ourselves. Patience is when we just stop and just say, it'll work its way out by itself. The water buffalo will run off, but eventually it will stop. We just have to wait. We can let go and just be kind and be gentle to ourselves and to everything. Always remember, this is just a movie play. Just the results of five khandhas, six sense bases, doing their thing, all according to cause and effect, but nothing substantial that I should be worried about or concerned about. That's why we can disengage. And I find that's one of the best antidotes to restlessness, because when I disengage, just watch all this stuff go, come and go, I undermine it. I take away its source of fuel. I understand, because of cause and effect, this thing is caused by something. What that cause was me getting involved, driving the whole process. And as soon as I stop driving the process and take away the engagement, imagine myself just like a person sitting in a movie theatre watching all this stuff come up in my body and mind, it starts to calm down and get quiet. Restlessness fades. Boredom disappears. And the quietness and the gentleness, the stillness of meditation starts to come up. Of course, sometimes you get the tiredness of the mind, you know, the dullness and sleepiness. And because that is a common problem, especially when we do lots of meditation, I've talked about that a lot in the past, but please remember never to fight that rest, that tiredness, that sleepiness. Don't make a war with it. I say that because that's been my bitter experience. That's what I was encouraged to do, and I found it so counterproductive. Every time you'd fight with the tiredness, you'd just get more tense. Of course you would. Fighting is not gentleness, it's not letting go, it's not kindness. It's actually a subtle form of ill will. I don't want that tiredness. Because a lot of time we engage with that tiredness and we think, I am tired. We get embarrassed or we get guilty. We get humiliated by the fact that, you know, you've been a monk for 33 years and you still can't, you know, keep a straight back at 4 o'clock in the morning. Whatever it is, or it's 5 o'clock in the morning, or you can't even get up for breakfast at 6:30 in the morning, whatever. No need to feel guilty about that. Because that just adds the sense of ego and self when you start to own these problems. So don't own your sleepiness. It's nothing to do with you, it's just cause and effect, that's all. So if sleepiness does come up, just stay with it. Be with it, watch it, be kind to it, be gentle to it. Investigate sleepiness. What does it feel like? How long does it last? What causes it? And what sort of things allow sleepiness just to fade away? And once it fades away, what's left afterwards? Because it's not just getting rid of the sleepiness at all costs. It's just what the result of, you know, you getting rid of that sleepiness is. Which is why I say that if you just force the mind, sure, the sleepiness can get overcome. You can do those meditations like sitting on the edge of a precipice. Or, you know, putting what we used to do in Thailand, you know, put the matchboxes on top of your head, or put pins to try, or get somebody to stand behind you with a stick to beat you if you start nodding even the slightest. Yeah, sure, that you won't nod if that happens, but the result is you've got tense, you're acting out of fear. So you're just getting rid of one defilement and replacing it with another. And that doesn't make any sense to me. Instead, that with that sleepiness and tiredness, again, you're patient. You let it be. You disengage. It's as if that you're just sitting there in a movie theater and just, you know, there's something wrong with the projector and you can't get a clear image. Or it's just, it's all dull. Doesn't matter, it's not your job. It's the proprietor of the movie theatre will fix that up. You just leave it alone and sit there. And with that patience, if it really is patience, and you've heard me say why this works, after a while the sloth and torpor, the tiredness just vanishes, just like the mist vanishes when the sun comes up. Just patience, that's all. Non-doing, allowing the mind to become energized. And that sort of little bit of mental science, knowing when the energy stops going into the doing, it will start to flow into the knowing, should give you a lot of faith. Once you understand that and see the truth of that very simple statement, mind energy can go to the doing or to the knowing, you understand just why you get tired or why you get restless. And what happens if you're just patient and do nothing? Just observe as best you can, be letting go, being kind, being gentle. Just imagine yourself just watching all of this, but not moving from your seat, not shouting at the movie, not getting your gun out and shooting the tiredness because you don't like it. When you actually you stop and just sit and watch as best you can, even with dullness, you know that the energy eventually does go into mindfulness. Just the mind brightens up. Understanding just that whole process, you know, why these things work, oh, that just makes meditation so much more easy and fun. You know how it all works. Once you know how it all works, you know why you make mistakes, you know why you can get peaceful and joyful and energetic. Trouble is that a lot of times that we haven't got enough confidence and faith just to be with the restlessness or be with the tiredness or be with the boredom. Instead, we just keep pushing it along. We just get involved rather than disengaged. And because of that involvement and trying to fix up the problems and doing this, and we just get tired. And because we get tired, we just make more problems for ourselves. That's why this wonderful way of just calming the sankharas, calming the mental activities, lessening the will, lessening the controlling, maybe by just contemplating non-self, there's no one to control this anyway, there's nobody in here, it's not my business, just leave it alone. You know that's all true Buddhism, that's exactly what it says in the suttas. When you understand, well, there's nothing here to do anything, it's not mine anyway, it's just five khandhas, so what the hell, why should I just struggle? Maybe that might be enough just to give you the confidence just to leave things alone and to know what leaving things alone truly is and how it all works. And then these hindrances are seen for what they are. Those five hindrances, I always say those first two are the most important, like desire and ill will. Desire, again, is just wanting something else. Ill will is just not wanting what you've got. It's all wanting. And when you want something else, that something else which you want, whether it's the next level of meditation or whether it's the end of the meditation period, whether it's a time to go and have breakfast or whether it's the end of the retreat or whatever else you're longing for or wanting for, you can see that wanting takes you away from where you are. It's just, they used to have these, they used to call the sirens. These were these mythical creatures who would sit on the rocks and they would lure unwary sailors because they had these whales which were just so enticing. It's in Greek mythology if I get it right. And they would wail their enchanting voices and the sailors would hear them, they'd be drawn and drawn towards them. But it was the rocks, the shipwrecks. And once the sailors were shipwrecked, I think these beings would eat all the sailors up. It was just, they were enticing. And sometimes that's what these desires do. They entice us and pull us onto the shipwreck of meditation. When we're just really fed up, getting no happiness, no peace, bored, fed up, had enough. It's always because these desires, they pull us away from where we belong. So we notice that. And instead of actually being pulled along, it's not my business, nothing to do with me. We just sit here. We don't move. We just watch. It's the desire creates a doing. Same as ill will. I'm not happy here. I want something else. That also creates a doing. It creates activity. So there's desire and ill will is what makes you move. What makes you get tired because you've been moving so much. What creates the activity of the mind. What disturbs and just agitates. Once one sees that desire and ill will and how it works, you say, no, I'm not going to get involved in that anymore. Instead, one says, this is good enough. A beautiful mantra which you used to use in Thailand, poor D, poor D, poor D. Poor D means good enough. It's a great little mantra to use in one's meditation. This is good enough. It doesn't matter what you're experiencing. If you're just, you know, your head's almost on the floor because you're so tired. This is good enough. And if you do that consistently, you have to be consistent with it. You can't say, well, 1 minute meditation, that's good enough. And then you sort of go and sleep, you know, for 12 hours. Remember, just you say 4 hours, 5 hours, this is good enough. You've got to be good enough to get up. Enough. So if you really do that good enough practice, it means that the desires and ill will are just very difficult to arise in the mind. Throughout the whole day, this moment is good enough. This moment is good enough. This moment is good enough. Or if you know Thai, you can breathe in, noticing poor. Breathe out, di, poor di, poor di, poor di. Good enough, good enough, good enough. And what that does, it gives you a satisfaction. And actually it's a strange thing happens that when you do overcome, or rather subdue, the desire which takes you away or the ill will which stops you staying here. This poor D, poor D, poor D gives you a sense of stillness. You tend not to move. You just stay. And because that poor D, poor D, poor D subdues those two hindrances of desire and ill will, because it creates a sense of immovability, of stillness, you start to recognize and experience the delight of meditation, the delight born of just being still, of wanting for nothing. In other words, nothing is wanting anything. You're not moving away. There's nothing you need, there's nothing you desire, that this really is good enough. Because what happens, that this is good enough, is just a beginning. And when you start to convince yourself that this is good enough, and you actually start to look and observe and be with what you have, it's not good enough anymore, it's actually damn good. It's incredibly good. It's immensely beautiful. Because when you stay with what you have, no matter where you start, it grows in beauty, in delight, in profundity. And that's why I, many years ago, so developed that simile of the lotus flower, the 1,000-petal lotus opening up. And it doesn't matter what lotus you begin with. The most unpromising lotus looks really dirty, scraggly, malformed, whatever. Any lotus will do. Because in every lotus there's a beautiful heart inside, the fragrant petals in the middle. What I mean by that is every experience which you have, even this one now, even the worst one you've had, the whole rains retreat, if you could only stay with that, not change it, not move it, not try and get rid of it, no desire, no ill will, but being with whatever it is, even pain, even just boredom, even desperation, even that lotus which is all black and desperate and ugly outside, if you just stay with it, it opens up. The more you stay with it, the more it opens up. The more you say good enough, and the more those ugly outer petals open to reveal less ugly petals. Less ugly petals, refined petals. And soon you get into the beautiful stuff. It's amazing to know that this is the way the mind works. Because it doesn't matter what you're experiencing, what you start off with, everything is useful. So you don't have to sort of get this rid of this and then so you can start meditation a few moments' time when you get rid of all these problems. Start with your problem. Be with it. Allow it to be. This is good enough. Don't move. No desire, no ill will. And you find your mind bores into it, opens it out, and what was once almost intolerable now is easily endured. And after it's easily endured, it actually becomes quite nice. And once it becomes quite nice, it becomes delightful. And it all started out from the most unpromising beginnings. That's why the simile of the lotus is a very beautiful and effective one. It doesn't matter what that lotus looks like when you first begin. Stay with it. No ill will, because it doesn't look nice. No desire looking for another lotus to go off to. Whatever you're experiencing, it's good enough. By doing this, you're abandoning so many of the obstacles of meditation. Which most of the obstacles of meditation is either ill will, I don't like this. I don't know where you got that ill will from. Always comparing and being negative. That's why the fault-finding mind should be abandoned by developing the opposite, which is an accepting, embracing, looking for the delight in things, looking for the beauty in things. And that looking for the beauty and delight in things, we're living in a very delightful monastery, especially at this time of the year. If ever you get really bored, just go and hunt for a kangaroo and just go and look at the joey poking its head out. Or, you know, watch it just jumping up and down. Watch the sort of the rain dripping from the edge of the leaves. Or just go out and look at the stars. So much beauty here. And if you look for that beauty, look for that delight, you find you just get into this habit of being not fault-finding, of actually seeing the beauty in things. And then you start to, whatever you're doing in your meditation, you start to look at this, and actually what you thought was ugly is actually very, very nice and beautiful. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, they say. And peace and success in meditation is in the attitude of the meditator. If you get that attitude right, Just kindness, gentleness, letting go. And the kindness bit is what I'm talking about now. You're so kind to things. That mothers are just really amazed how mothers can love their kids. Little monsters sometimes who come to the monastery and think, how can a mother ever love that? Maybe because I'm a monk and that's probably why I never had a family. But nevertheless, sometimes you look, gee, how can she stand that? And still that little monster, you can see her cradling her and just looking after her. And even though it climbs all over your back and half strangles you, still the mother loves that kid. And if a mother can love that, gee, surely you can love your mind. Okay, it's a little bit delinquent sometimes, but you know that it's good enough. And when you develop that sort of appreciation, that joy, that looking for the happiness in the mind, meditation again becomes so easy. The good enough becomes very easy to do, because actually you haven't got such great demands. You haven't got such great demands of yourself or about life or about the world or this monastery. When you haven't got such great demands, then it's much easier to appreciate it. And because you are not demanding in nature, contented and easily satisfied, which is the translations of the words in that Metta Sutta. Contented and easily satisfied, not demanding in nature. Do that with your mind as well. Ask yourself when you're meditating, are you demanding? I better get into jhana in this retreat or else. I'm going to go up to Ajahn Brahm and ask for my money back. I better get at least peaceful, at least a nimitta this time. If you're demanding like that, you're never going to get anywhere in the meditation. Just be contented. Build up that contentment. Be easily satisfied. Then you get the jhanas. Not when you want them, but when you build up the causes. The causes are the stillness of the mind. Stillness maintained over long periods of time. Where the energy just pours into just pure knowing. When just the mind just goes deep into that lotus and it opens stage by stage, not on your schedule when you want it to, but according to its own natural schedule and timetable. And it just happens because you're still. And you're still because you're content. Content with little and easily satisfied, not demanding things. When you can do that in your daily life, you're building up the causes for deep meditation. Restlessness is when you aren't easily satisfied, when you are very demanding, when you want so much. And you get into this terrible cycle. Because you want something, you get restless and you don't get what you want anyway, and that makes you want even more, and you get this terrible wanting cycle. You know what it's like sometimes, and you're desperate in your huts. You don't want to walk, you don't want to sit down, you don't want to sleep. You've done, rah! I've got nothing I want to do. But whatever I'm doing now, I hate it, I don't want it. It's a terrible situation to be in where nothing satisfies you whatsoever. It's just because you've developed that. You've created the causes through wrong attitudes and bad attention. If you develop the satisfaction, the calmness, being easily satisfied, contented, you will find that that is not just shirking, it's not putting off the task, it's creating the causes that powerful meditation happens. And through that contentment, easily satisfied, not demanding in nature, that stillness, that this is good enough, you just sit there and everything starts to happen. Think, wow, at last I can do this. And you find that it's not that you're doing things, it's you're not getting in the way. The process happens when you disappear. When you're demanding, you are there. When you have ill will, you are there. When you have craving, you are there. When you have boredom, you are there. All these things is creating this sense of a self which is owning and getting involved. You are the problem. And if you leave this monastery and go somewhere else, you take yourself with you. So really, there should be, everyone in this monastery should disrobe. The I should disrobe. The Ajahn Brahm, the Ajahn Jayasiri, the Ajahn Brahmali, that which you take yourself to be, that sense of self, that's the one which should leave and vanish. The I, the Atta, the self. When that disappears, then of course there's no ill will, there's no desire. There can only be contentment and peace. So that when you just start disappearing, no wanting to get things, no trying to get somewhere. That's all part of ego and self. When I was a kid, I used to be in the Boy Scout Cubs and used to get all these badges for things, a badging for being able to make a cup of tea, a badge for being able to light a fire. That's what many people do in monasteries, they just want to get a badge for getting jhana, a badge for getting stream winner, a badge for being able to do the Patimokkha, and a badge for, I don't know what else you get badges for in this monastery. They don't have badges in meditation. He's trying to get rid of all those badges and who you think you are. And that way that we can just disappear. And when we disappear, everything becomes just so peaceful and nice. So when you're restless, just disappear. When you're tired, just disappear. When you're bored, who's being bored anyway? Just boredom, it's nature. So you just disappear and boredom will just vanish. By being content and easily satisfied, this is good enough. You'll find that all these glitches on the path, they're only the beginning of the path, and after a while they just vanish, and then you're flying, getting into nice meditations, being able to spend hours in your heart and having a happy time. If that's not happening yet, be patient, it will. Doesn't matter how many years. What was it? Anuruddha was 16 or 17 years, or was it 9 years? I forget now, before he got his act together. So give it time. Even in the suttas, when they say, in no long time, this man from a good family went forth and eventually became an arahat. When it says in no long time, that's, you know, in the Buddhist idea of, like, you know, Buddha remembering 91 eons. So now, 10 or 15 or 20 years is no long time when you consider the extent of samsara. So don't expect things to happen immediately. Your job is just to be quiet, be calm, be still, be peaceful. Don't go holding on to that water buffalo. Don't go chasing it. Develop the letting go. Develop the contentment. Develop the this is good enough. And by doing such things, you're developing these other tools. And sometimes you use these attitudes and tools for a while, and then it doesn't work again. Then you use another tool, and then you use another tool. But little by little, you have enough strategies there to get you through those beginning glitches. And then once the mind starts to really develop, and you start to get peaceful and happy, then we can really get into the meditation. But really then you don't need all that much help. I can give you a bit of sort of instructions, but then you're off having happy times as monks, sannyasinis, novices or whatever. And that's what I want for you for this retreat, to develop the happy meditations by overcoming these obstacles. And there today is a few little pieces of advice to overcome them. So that's today's talk.